From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Detroit strikes important pension deals with all its retirees. Now what?
I think you're going to have a lot of people kind of breathe a sigh of relief here and say, I can live with this.
Plus, GM checks the status of the shield, protecting it from damage claims that predate its 2009 bankruptcy.
The people who bought shares of the new GM bought those shares with the idea that those liabilities were left behind.
And we look at the rise in thrift shops throughout Michigan.
I can find something unique and cool. I can do it at a lower price. I can get more for less. People find it appealing to buy unique thrift store items in an era of kind of mass consumption where there's a lot of similarity and uniformity.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. There used to be a stigma around buying resale. Now there is no shame in the resale game. Hello, I'm Cynthia Canty. Welcome to Stateside. Data shows that resale and thrift shops are doing better than ever right now, with stores popping up all over the country, attracting larger numbers of shoppers from different backgrounds. Today on Stateside, we look at the resale economy in this age of online shopping. Then General Motors is asking a bankruptcy judge to double-check the status of that shield that protects the automaker from damage claims that predate its 2009 bankruptcy. We'll have more on that later this hour. But first, it is turning into a momentous few days in Detroit's quest to exit bankruptcy. First came a deal with two global banks, UBS and Bank of America. Then an agreement with leaders of Detroit's retired police and firefighters. And that was followed late yesterday by a settlement with the remaining Detroit retirees. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes joins us now. And Daniel, if we looked at all of this as a baseball game and crossing home plate represents Detroit's exit from bankruptcy, what base is the city on?
They're at least on second, I would think, and looking at third. I think a lot of people that have been following this and understand this process have known for a long time that the key to unlocking this bankruptcy was going to be the pension funds and the pensioners, the retirees more generally. Mm-hmm. And I think there was growing concern on the part of emergency manager Kevin Orr and his team, as well as the governor and his team, that draconian cuts by the court in the middle of the summer, as we were going into a general election, were going to be a spectacle that nobody wanted. And I think that includes Judge Rhodes as well. And I think that's why he was issuing some very strong language and using strong language last week from the bench and basically saying it's time to end the PR campaigns and it's time for you guys to really get serious about negotiating.
And that was really aimed at both parties, at all parties.
That was aimed at everybody.
Everybody.
Because it was clear for several weeks that Kevin Orr was on a PR campaign and he was selling. I think you and I talked about
yes.
that a couple weeks ago, that he was in a selling mode and he kept talking about this deal and why they needed to take the deal. And conversely, I think you had the pension funds, the unions, and others doing their level best to push back. And they were going around doing backgrounders with us and others and talking about what the real numbers were and kept focusing on the totality of the cut. It wasn't just the pension fund cut. It was the loss of a cost of living allowances. Mm-hmm. It was loss of paid health care for retirees. And by the end of last week, I was pretty pessimistic.
We talked about that. You very much were.
And the DIA would be back in play again, et cetera, et cetera. You know, a couple of things have happened. One, I think Judge Rhodes pushed them. Two, the bullish market and the performance of these pension funds in 2013 changed the math.
Okay.
The return for the police and fire pension fund in 2013 was 18.5%. That's a huge number, and it really enabled them to kind of look at some of the metrics, and they agreed to raise what's called the discount rate, which is what they expect to earn over a long period of time, not to 18%, clearly, but what that number is has a dramatic effect on a pension funds the size we're talking about here. A one-point movement either way can represent $750 million.
So they had more money to work with.
They had a little bit more to work with, but I think the other thing that you're not hearing about so much right now, and one of the real battlegrounds is still to play out, is going to be a change in the governance and leadership of these pension funds, because there's a belief that two things. One is shoddy governance and bad leadership got them into some very difficult positions that they've only recently been trying to dig out of.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, you're not going to get 18.5% returns every year in the investment market. So you have to be able to take the good years and pay it ahead for when the bad years are there and not be sending people 13th checks and all that kind of stuff that got them into a lot of trouble.
So we know that the pension boards agreed to benefit cuts that were much lower than we heard of in the plan of adjustment, 4.5% cuts for the monthly pension checks. But and we heard police and fire retirees will have no cuts in monthly checks and some cuts in COLA. But now we look at the VEBA, and we all remember that was a big part of the GM and Chrysler bankruptcy process. Tell us what that means for these retirees. How does that work?
I mean, a VEBA is essentially a health care trust that is created and funded by the city up to a point, and it's used to help them defray their health costs. How the mechanics of that are ultimately going to work are a little less clear right now. In the case of the auto companies, they funded it with some of their cash and stock and other things like that. Well, the city doesn't have something like that. But I think what's interesting and what's developing here is two different strains. You're having people talk about how nothing has changed, that because the police and fire, for example, are not getting their pensions cut, nothing has changed. Why did we go through this whole exercise of bankruptcy? Well, I think people are really oversimplifying this. A lot has changed. And one of them is retiree health care and the creation of the VEBA. That takes that obligation off the long-term balance sheet of the city. And there are a number of other things that are being taken off the balance sheet by this whole process, whether it's, and we've talked about this, whether it's the interest rate swaps, agreements with Bank of America and UBS, or it's probably the first certificates of participation burden that is still to be litigated. So I think when we get to the end of this process, you are going to see the debts of the city adjusted. And remember, this is called a plan of adjustment.
Mm-hmm.
It's not called a debt elimination plan. It's called an adjustment plan. You're not eliminating the city's debts. You're adjusting them to a way that can be sustainable so they're not back in Chapter 9 5 years from now.
Daniel, should we expect the retirees to approve these deals?
Well, you know, it's going to be very interesting. I think the sentiment last week, clearly, that you saw on message boards and on comments on our stories and columns was, I think, decidedly negative. You know, there's no question that initially this was looking to be a lot worse than it appears that it's going to end up to be. I think you're going to have a lot of people kind of breathe a sigh of relief here and say, I can live with this. I don't like it, but I can live with this. And if they do vote it down, then it does get worse because you lose $816 million and potentially some other things that are being talked about. Both Detroit papers today are reporting about some discussions with the Obama administration about using some federal money for blight removal that would then free up additional funds that the state could move around, essentially, to benefit pensions.
That could be $100 million.
Right. But if they were to vote this thing down, I think all the wheels come off the wagon, and I think then you potentially would be looking at a cram down from the judge down the road. And what you see from the leadership is a recognition that we do not want to be subject, and we don't want our people to be subject to a cram down. And I think the people who would be doing the cramming down, Kevin Warr and essentially Governor Rick Snyder, they don't want to do it either for reasons that should be pretty obvious.
Right. Well, the idea that possibly with a cram down, you could see a 26% monthly pension cut for the police and fire and 34% for the retirees, this, I'm sure, is looking better.
Yeah. And I don't know that even those numbers would hold, Cynthia, because of some of the performance of these pension funds. I mean, we may have turned a corner here in two ways. One is being able to offer them cuts that are palatable, if a little distasteful, and two is laying the table for getting much better, more disciplined management of these pension funds who are designed to benefit the people who work for the city, not for the 5 or 10 or 15 people who happen to be elected and be on the boards of those pension funds. And you've got people that are pushing back because they've got their own little fiefdom. Well, essentially what they're saying here is as a condition of this deal, you're not going to have those fiefdoms anymore, and it's going to be more professionally run, and that's going to be the exchange. Now, in the case of police and fire, they've already kind of moved in that direction, and I think they need some credit for that. But there's a long legacy of sloppiness that they've got to get away from, and they're clearly going to move in that direction under this.
I think we need to look at the next big challenge. Is that water?
Yes, I don't think there's any question. You know, this week the judge could order federal mediation, and if you look at what's happened here, the deals that have been done with the mediation team led by Chief District Judge Jerry Rosen, it is proving to be very effective. and is proving to move very quickly. And I think what happens is you finally are going to get in the room some negotiators from the city and from the counties, and essentially people wearing black robes are going to say, all right, let's stop this finger-pointing about who's not getting what information. You know, Kevin Orr has addressed this issue. He issued a letter. I wrote about it.
Mm-hmm.
And guess what I heard as a result of that?
What?
Zip. Nothing. And I know some of those people, and they, believe me, if they took issue with some of the things that were in that or the contentions that Kevin Orr made, I'd have heard about it. But they didn't, because they know that, I think, that fundamentally what he was saying and the information that he said he had given, his team had given to them in the number of meetings is true. I think this could be very fruitful to have a federal mediator involved here and to basically say, okay, let's everybody take the temperature down a little bit. Mm-hmm. Let's see where we are in terms of the information, and let's start getting serious about what some of the options are here. I think it could prove to be very effective, but I do think it is the big thing now. If you assume that the pension thing goes forward and the DIA grand bargain actually does get accepted.
Well, and that's the final question. I wondered, with these developments in the last few days and these pieces falling into place, what does that mean in terms of what is now expected of Lansing and that $815 million grand bargain in Lansing's share?
Well, I don't think there's any question that the governor and the Republican leadership in both houses have to deliver. They know they have to deliver. Balloting begins May 1st. It's a 60-day window, so it would go to the end of June. And the governor has made it very clear, as have the legislative leadership, that they expect to drop legislation to take it up and move it by the end of May or early June as part of their legislative action and the budget process. That would mean it would fall right in the middle of this balloting period. So if you are a retiree, I think it is entirely reasonable to say, you know what, I got this ballot, I can look through it in May, I can sit down with my family, I can sit down with whoever I need to talk to about this, but I got to wait and see what these people in Lansing are going to do. But I think in terms of knowing how this plays out, we're not going to really know how it plays out until the end of June.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Do you shop resale? Do you have a favorite thrift shop or consignment store? Well, chances are good you are nodding your head and saying, yes, I do. The business of selling secondhand goods has become a $13 billion a year industry in this country. It's grown about 7% over each of the past 2 years. You'll find resale, thrift, and consignment shops in most Michigan cities and towns. What's behind this growth, and what does this resale economy offer us? We're joined by Brenda Parker. She's a professor of urban planning at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and she recently co-authored a piece on the restructuring of retail economies in this era of e-commerce. It was published in Urban Geography. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Very good to have you with us. And we're happy to welcome Chantal McDaniel. She's based in Grand Haven, and she writes a thrift fashion blog. It's called Thrift Trick, Miles of Fashion on a Shoestring. Chantal, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much.
Brenda, the idea of resale isn't new, but what do you feel is behind this growth in resale activity in this country?
Right. Well, I think there are a couple of different sort of trends that are happening. I mean, certainly what we've seen is the expansion of opportunities for purchasing secondhand, right? So that we see the growth in local thrift store economies, but also the growth of online thrift and secondhand economies. So we see the growth and opportunity for purchasing secondhand, again, in your pajamas at home or, you know, walking around a cool neighborhood. I think a second piece of this is that the idea has simply become more mainstream and more acceptable. I mean, we can look at some of that having to do with the recession, right, where people have had to make do with less, but also I think with the notion that people find it appealing to buy unique thrift store items in an era of kind of mass consumption where there's a lot of similarity and uniformity. So people find the idea that I can find something unique and cool. I can do it at a lower price. I can get more for less.
And your research indicates that the resale market is really integral to the character of communities. How so?
Right. So, I mean, we thought about thrift stores and secondhand exchange being valuable to cities and communities for several reasons. I mean, one is it helps contribute to vibrant and unique neighborhoods. So we all like to go to neighborhoods that are a little idiosyncratic. You know, they're interesting. They've got a unique little store that you might find something very original in. second is that it's kind of a low point of entry for entrepreneurs, and women in particular. Women and minorities tend to be the ones that open some of these independent thrift store shops. So you can do so without necessarily a huge amount of upfront capital, assuming that you can afford the rent, right? And then third, it really allows products for a wide range of consumers, right? So people who are shopping more on a budget, people who are, trying to make do with less, and then also people who really do want that kind of unique find. They like the experience of thrift store shopping. And then finally, as you mentioned, you know, we like the fact that it extends the life cycle of goods. If it's a local retail shop, often they reinvest back in the local community. So there's kind of a positive local and environmental effect.
You kind of think about there are resale businesses, but there are different types. Chantal, can you spell out for us the distinctions among the different kinds of resale businesses?
Well, I'm always joking about being able to smell a deal. I know for some people that I have as friends and colleagues, they get a little nervous about secondhand shopping, particularly if they think that the store is a little grungy. For me, the smell of rubbish means the smell of a deal, you know. So I like going into my down and out grungy thrift stores because I know I'm going to find great deals there. But I shop at, you know, lots of different stores. Some of them are local mission thrifts that are really, you know, little tiny resale shops. Some of them are consignment, like you mentioned, where people are bringing in upscale items to be sold. Trading in items, getting store credits for that, or, having a third party sell their items for them. You know, I grew up in this way of life. It was a necessity for me growing up in a home where we didn't have a lot. And then, you know, it became more than that. And in those days, I think there was somewhat of a shame associated with buying secondhand items, you know. But now, I think people feel more smart when they say, hey, you know, check out this Coach bag that I got for $2 and this Vera Wang dress I'm wearing. By the way, this cocktail dress was $3, you know, and people are taking note and saying, actually, wait a minute, this is smart. And, you know, I'm doing something, I'm reducing my carbon footprint.
I'm talking with Chantal McDaniel, who writes a thrift fashion blog called Thrift Trick, Miles of Fashion on a Shoestring. She's based in Grand Haven. And we're speaking with Brenda Parker, who's a professor of urban planning at the University of Chicago. And Brenda, the piece you did on secondhand economy, if you will, for urban geography, addressed the modern twist to all of this, which is e-commerce. So what impact did you find online ventures are having on these brick-and-mortar stores?
There's definitely intensified pressure for both customers and for supplies, but there's also more of a kind of fluidity and hybridity. So we find actually that eBay and, what we call bricks and mortar, you know, those stores that you walk into, they may be actually reinforcing each other more than we think. So that, you know, thrift shoppers, we like to buy online and we like to go to these stores and have that cool experience. And we find that some of these retailers in local neighborhoods are selling online as well as in place. We find that people are selling on eBay some of the goods that they actually purchased at a thrift store and vice versa. We find people consign locally, and then they also sell some of their own things on eBay. So again, as we think about repurposing and how good that is, one of the less than positive findings is that both sort of the sales of new goods and the sales of used goods are kind of going upward in the same trajectory. And part of that may be we buy more new goods knowing that we can resell them, right, on eBay
yes.
or at thrift stores. So, you know, economists will call that sort of a perverse incentive, right, that we're buying more, we're seeing more of a fluidity with online markets and in-store markets and also with new and used, right? So that eBay sells new goods as well as used goods. In fact, about 40% of the clothing markets are new goods. Thrift stores sell some new goods, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're just seeing more, again, sort of integration across these sectors.
And have you seen that reflected throughout West Michigan, Chantal, as you prowl around and look for treasures? Has there been an increase in shops, and are they doing well?
I think so. I think that there are, if nothing else, they're steady. I mean, I would love to see even more popping up. I think maybe, consignment stores might be on the rise as far as what I'm noticing. I know that the economy in Michigan hasn't always been, you know, the greatest, and we're seeing, this huge wave of microbreweries popping up, and I think there's, an application that goes beyond just fashion, but we say, you know, in the thrift fashion world, I guess, the slow movement, meaning, you know, slowing down,
yes.
slowing your consumption,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. and buying secondhand. And I think people are definitely, you know, picking up on that trend, and there are changes happening. So, yes, I would say there's definitely an increase of stores around, an increase of people who are you know, looking for that brick and mortar, and then also online secondhand selling with, you know, huge websites like Discogs and things like that. But I think people are really picking up on that trend in Michigan, and I hope it's here to stay.
My failure.
I felt totally bamboozled.
And I thought, this has to end. I can't do this anymore.
Here's Rick Bierhorst.
Hello, my name is Rick Bierhorst, and I live here in Grand Rapids. I'm a fine artist and a musician. I'm father of six kids, and my wife Brenda is also a painter. And I'm here tonight to share my glorious failure with regard to moving to New York City. You know, New York is a city that I fell in love with when I was 20. I went to New York on an interim from Calvin College and stayed in a loft in Tribeca with 10 or 11 other students. And when I was there, you know, I had grown up in Kentwood, and I had been very firmly embedded in suburban culture. So to suddenly be in New York in the early 80s was like amazing. And it was also like, you know, it was like coming home too. I was just coming into the awareness of being an artist and what that meant. And this was the place in the world you'd want to be. New York City has been the art capital of the world since after World War II. And so it was just fantastic. I managed to move to New York about a year after college and lived there for just about a year. Went to graduate school, came back here, met Brenda, got married, started having children. And then it's 2002, and Brenda and I start having this conversation about what would it mean to move our family to New York City. And we gave ourselves 3 years. And that was really a test, too, because we have lots of ideas all the time, and this could just be one of those what we call caffeine dreams. And we figured, you know, if it died away in a couple months, like most of our ideas, you know, okay, it's on the scrap pile. But this idea didn't die away. In fact, it gathered momentum. And so we found a artist cooperative in Brooklyn that we could buy into. It was just for artists, and they were making it available far below market value. So that sounded good to us. We put our house up for sale, and it sold. It was 2005, you know, and it sold really fast and for a lot more than we paid for it. So we had some cash. But then we found out that this co-op actually got all bound up in New York City red tape, and it wasn't going to be available. So then what were we to do? Well, we had to rent. Rose, my oldest daughter, and I went before the family, scout out a place. We found an apartment. The only way the landlord would take us on as tenants was if we were to pay the whole year's rent up front. That's because I never made any more than $30,000 a year, and to a New Yorker, that's like way below the poverty line. So that was the deal we worked out. So we wired $27,000 to this landlord. And, of course, you have to pay a key money to the broker. That was a whole other thing. But we got our apartment. We got our place to live. We got rid of about half of our belongings, packed what we had left in a U-Haul, and with our late model station wagon behind, we drove out to New York. We started having engine trouble in Ohio with the U-Haul. Okay, it was a nightmare, people. I don't have time for all the details. We finally got to New York. The movers had come and left already. It was pouring rain. The super, who spoke barely any English, mostly Russian, was very angry with me because I was using the wrong door. You know, we got into our apartment, and the remodel wasn't done. The bathroom was almost completely unusable, and there was just a subfloor in the kitchen. So what was I going to do? Not, you know, pay a month's rent? I felt totally bamboozled, you know, like a suckered hillbilly from Michigan. Well, that was our baptism by fire, which I found out later. There's a lot of New York stories like that. Well, we did eventually get acclimated. We had a fantastic summer and this incredible city to explore, the Metropolitan, the Museum of Modern Art, the best galleries in the world. We were meeting interesting people. And then that began to kind of run its course. And then as we moved into the fall and then the winter settled in. So six children, the youngest was one, just learned to walk. And we went anywhere in the subways. That meant we went on the subway with two kids in strollers. So you're in a busy subway station. You're carrying strollers up, you know, stairs in the midst of all these people. And it was just weird to have six kids in New York. Nobody has, outside of the Hasidic, you know, community, nobody has six kids. I mean, it's weird here. It's even weirder there. And one of the reasons we went to New York was we were tired of being weird here. We thought we could go there. You know, and we'd have a break for it. We just found it. Still, we were standing out like a sore thumb. So, our biggest thing was we were not prepared financially, probably, and culturally for the transition we had to make. So, one of my daily rituals at night, I'd go online and check my bank account balance. And it was like sand running out of, you know, an hourglass, like in The Wizard of Oz. And I was really, really getting nervous about this because it was taking a lot longer than I anticipated to actually develop the connections that we needed to make this sustainable. I did get picked up by a gallery in Chelsea pretty quickly because they knew my work from Chicago. I'd shown in Chicago for years. But then after about 2 months and nothing was happening, he kind of leveled with me. He just felt like my work didn't fit the gallery. That was a huge disappointment. The kids were starting to really... You know, the newness had worn off, and especially the older ones could really begin to voice their, you know, displeasure about this whole thing. Like, we want to go back to Grand Rapids. And then we found out from our landlord that he was going through a divorce and he was going to be selling the apartment. We weren't going to be able to renew our lease. Well, we thought, well, maybe we can still buy a place. So I went to my bank, Chase. I had a talk with a mortgage guy there who was in charge, and he said that they had this thing called the no-doc loan. And I said I needed $350,000. That's like just to buy a junker, fixer-upper in a very pioneering part of Brooklyn. And he said, we can do that. We can do a no-doc loan, $350,000, no problem. And as much as I wanted to stay in New York and buy a little piece, I knew this in my heart was not a good idea. And I decided not to do this. This was 2000, just beginning of 2006. And we know what happened in 2008. So I came back from an excursion in the city one day, late winter, and the kids were jumping up and down on the bed saying, we want to go back to Michigan, we want to go back to Michigan. You know, like it turned it into some kind of a chant or a song. And there was something inside of me that was just kind of tumbling down this black hole. You know, I felt like it was almost like I was wearing the sweater and they were just unraveling it, and I was just watching it kind of disappear on me. We had this notion of what New York was and what it was going to be for us and how it was going to open up all these great opportunities. And, you know, it didn't turn out that way. You know, it turned out really hard, way harder than we anticipated. And then it came time to rent another truck and pack up again and move out and say goodbye to neighbors and some of the people that we had, you know, begun some intimate relationships with. And then there was a whole thing of just, you know, the people back home, what are they going to think? We had this great last family art show. You know, we thought it was our last, and people were, you know, this might be our last chance to buy a cheap beer horse. But now we were coming home. And the other part of that was, you know, when you buy a new a camping tent, and you pull it out of that bag and it slides right out and it's all like packed really tight. And then you have your camping trip, right? And then it's time to go home and it's like, oh my God, I've got the poles in there, the stick. How in the world could I ever get it back in? And that's kind of like us now. It's kind of like we got unpacked. How could we ever fit back into that bag? So, you know, in a sense, it was a dream that just kind of collapsed on itself. Thank you.
That was Rick Bierhorst telling his story of failure. You can find out more about Failure Lab and hear more stories at failure-lab.com. Welcome back to Stateside. General Motors is asking a bankruptcy judge in New York to take a look at its shield, the shield that protects it from liability lawsuits stemming from crashes or defects that happened before its 2009 bankruptcy. Veteran auto analyst Michelle Krebs joins us. So what is GM asking this bankruptcy judge to do, and why in New York?
Well, General Motors' 2009 bankruptcy took place in the court in New York. What GM is asking is asking to be shielded from the legal claims over these ignition switch lawsuits, and there are many of those. There are some in Texas, there are some in California, a number of them. And the idea is, with bankruptcy, supposedly, General Motors left all of those behind because the problems occurred before the 2009 bankruptcy.
So GM officials aren't publicly talking about what this request means. What's your take on this request?
Well, I think they have a fiduciary responsibility to do this to their shareholders, because the people who bought shares of the new GM bought those shares with the idea that those liabilities were left behind. Now, there are other legal responsibilities and certainly civic, as Mary Barra has said, responsibilities, and maybe moral responsibilities to deal with these cases. I don't think this automatically means all of these cases just go away.
And that's what I wondered. How might a judge confirming this shield affect these families that have been impacted by the defective ignition switch?
Well, the other move that General Motors made the week of the congressional hearings, Mary Barra announced that General Motors had hired Kenneth Feinberg to help GM consider compensation to victims of the faulty ignition switch. So it doesn't necessarily mean they do not get anything.
And Kenneth Feinberg, we should inject, was involved with the 9/11 survivors.
Right.
Families.
He did. He was involved with the compensation to 9/11 victims, the BP oil spill, I believe Katrina, and also Boston bombing.
Other GM news. There have been some changes on GM's executive chessboard. We hear that head of HR and GM's top communications guy have, and that left to pursue other interests. GM's treasurer, Jim Dablin, is leaving. Is CEO Mary Barra doing what many new CEOs would do, putting her team in place, or is any of this tied to the ignition switch crisis?
Oh, I think this is absolutely her putting her team in place. She spent 18 months in the HR department, so she probably figured out who were the talented people she wanted to work with. The public relations position is a really critical position right now because in addition to all the legal issues that GM is encountering with the ignition switch problem, there's a PR aspect to that. And so I'm not surprised. The person that has left GM was put in place by not even Dan Akerson, the previous CEO, but Ed Whitaker, the one before that.
So she's getting her team in line.
She's absolutely getting her team in line, and she wants a team that will do her mission that she wants and that she has confidence in.
Auto analyst Michelle Krebs. As always, thanks, Michelle.
Thank you.
This is the future.
You built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
It's alive, it's alive!
It's the sound of science!
Ever since Stephen Hawking came out with his black hole theory, physicists, including Hawking himself, have been wrestling with a hole in that theory. That hole is called the information paradox. Well, now comes a theoretical physicist and computational biologist from Michigan State University who believes he has solved the hole in Hawking's black hole theory. Chris Adami, very good to have you on Stateside.
Hi, Cindy. It's my pleasure.
So for those of us who are more than a little rusty in our physics, give us a refresher on exactly what Stephen Hawking's black hole theory is.
So black holes, I mean, you know, kids like black holes already, and that's probably because they're huge, they're big, and they're sort of awe-inspiring. But before Hawking's discovery in 1975, black holes were really this, black. You know, they were the remnants of stars that had exploded, but they were so massive that the remainder of the star would sort of fall into itself, basically leaving nothing but mass behind. And so the interesting thing about this black hole was that there was something called a horizon, which is, you know, a few kilometers out of where the center of the star would have been, where if you're inside of this horizon, you could try to, you know, shine a flashlight out and the light would not come out. It would sort of like come back at you as if you, you know, had thrown a ball up that would come back at you, except that the gravitational pull is so high that even light would come back. So in other words, nothing could escape the black hole, and from the outside, it would therefore look completely black. Now, what Hawking discovered in 75 is that this isn't really true because of the fact that what we call the vacuum, which normally would be the absence of everything, mm-hmm. isn't really just an absence, but in fact, the vacuum is sort of fizzing with particles and antiparticles that are being created in pairs and then immediately have to come back together again and annihilate. And this fizzing that happens everywhere in space, but it happens in particular close to the horizon of a black hole. And if it happens there, then you can imagine that one particle antiparticle pair is being created, and one of them falls into the black hole and the other one manages to get out. And now it looks as if the black hole was actually radiating something, as if it was glowing. And that is this radiation effect that Hawking discovered. But that was not the thing that caused the problem. What caused the problem is that as this radiation is being created, somebody has to pay the energy bill for it, and that's the black hole. Ah. So the black hole actually has to shrink in mass for this radiation to come out. And so the idea would be if you just wait long enough, then the black hole would completely disappear. But then, of course, you would say, well, what happened with all the stuff that fell in, the informations, the patterns, the songs, the different ways in which you can, you know, throw stuff into the black hole. So all these patterns from the past, where would they be if everything is gone? And Hawking himself postulated that, well, it means that they're all gone, except that the laws of physics don't really allow for such a disappearance of these patterns that we call information. And so people had thought, you know, since 1975 that we don't understand how the universe works, because on the one hand, information is not allowed to be lost, and on the other hand, Hawking just showed us that, well, if the black hole disappears, then all is lost.
So that was the information paradox?
That is the information paradox, and it has preoccupied physicists now for about 40 years since that initial discovery.
And including you, and you now believed you have solved the information paradox.
Yes, well, so the reason why I think I have solved it is because I've been thinking about it for quite a while. So in the mid-90s, I worked in an area of physics which is known as the theory of quantum computation. And there we looked at this concept of information from a quantum theoretic point of view. So we knew how to treat the quantumness of information. And when I saw, you know, the papers about the black hole paradox, I thought to myself, first of all, you know, I don't think this loss of information is possible. And second of all, I thought, let's just calculate, you know, how much information is in fact lost, if it should be lost.
Mm-hmm.
And the way you do that in the field of quantum computation is you would calculate the capacity of the channel to transmit this information. And I happen to know how to do these type of calculations. So together with a grad student at the time, I sat down and I calculated it. And lo and behold, I realized that, in fact, the black hole does not swallow up information. But the only reason I was able to do that is because I discovered that one of the things that is extraordinarily important when dealing with black holes, that, however, Stephen Hawking had not given sufficient attention to, was the fact that they not just radiate this glow, this of Hawking radiation, they also stimulate the emission of radiation, which means that if I send something into the black hole will attempt to make a copy of it. So in other words, I send in letter A, and then at the edge of the black hole, you know, you get two letters A. One of them is falling in, and the other one actually, you know, stays outside.
Huh.
This effect of stimulated emission was discovered by Albert Einstein in 1917, and he showed that if you would not consider this effect, then you would get lots of paradoxes. And lo and behold, these paradoxes became apparent if you neglected the effect. So it's almost like at the edge of the black hole, there's this huge copy machine that, just to make sure that the laws of physics aren't broken, makes copies of the information just before they fall inside. And that is, in fact, how we avoid the problem of the loss of information.
And I've actually seen your solution described as an elegant solution. What are you hearing from your peers as word of this is getting out?
So I've described this theory in the last 10 years to a number of different physicists, and it is true that usually, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is that it is an elegant solution, but it's really because of the fact that, in a sense, it's not my solution, it's Albert Einstein's solution, in a sense. Not that he, you know, would have known how to do this calculation nowadays, but the effect was there all the time. I didn't have to add any new effect to black hole physics. So many of the attempts, and by the way, I'm not the first one who claims to have solved this problem, but most of the attempts that came before me tried to come up with a new physics that would save the universe. However, I didn't have to invent any new physics. I just had to point out that there was a piece of it invented or discovered by Albert Einstein that if you use it judiciously in the context of, you know, the framework of quantum communication theory, that all these paradoxes fall to the wayside.
You connected the dots.
Well, in a sense, I was at the right place at the right time. So, you know, I just made sure that, you know, everybody is aware of the fact that the laws of physics, you know, are not so easily broken. You know, the way I really got into this field is the moment I looked at these papers and they were telling me that information was absolutely lost. From my understanding of physics, it always made me physically sick. I just could not look at this and say, oh, well. No, there had to be a way out. This could not be correct. And it is what drove me for the last 10 years to make sure that everybody else understands that indeed the laws of physics do not allow such a travesty, but in fact make sure that information is perfectly preserved.
I have to wonder, have you heard at all from Stephen Hawking?
I have not heard from Stephen Hawking, and you know, he's not a very communicative person, as you can imagine. Mm. And I have no way of knowing whether, in fact, you know, he's even aware of this theory. Even though I think that I would imagine that he would like this solution simply because what it means is that his theory was correct to begin with. You know, it was not incorrect. It was just missing an ingredient that was, in fact, there. And had he been aware of it, you know, he would have immediately made use of it. So now I have some colleagues that have been going around discussing this theory outside. You know, I had just a colleague who discussed this theory in England. And so my suspicion is that, you know, there's going to be an avalanche effect at some point. However, you know, it is not easy to change the thinking of an entire generation of physicists. I realize it's a slow process, and I don't think everybody will immediately, you know, run and stand behind this theory. However, I'm working on a number of different manuscripts right now that have the same ingredient and show that it solves a number of other problems that are sometimes involved with black holes. So, you know, I think it's just a matter of time, but it could take 10 years until, you know, everybody is convinced.
Chris, what do you believe your theory means now for really our understanding of what happens in our universe?
Well, I think, you know, it is important to be confident that the framework that we are using in order to describe all of nature, including, of course, the entire universe, you know, it's not arbitrary. I mean, you know, it's not like, you know, suddenly things can go wrong, you know, given you know, the type of understanding that we have. We are usually extremely accurate in our ability to make predictions about, you know, the physical world. And it was sort of odd that there was this this one area that you know had a you know a major paradox of conflicting views and conflicting thoughts in theoretical physics. But on the other hand, this is in fact the area where our understanding of physics is the weakest, simply because while we have a unified theory for you know electromagnetic weak. And the strong forces, gravity is not included in that grand unification. So we don't really have a consistent theory that would completely and fully describe these black holes, which are at the same time quantum objects. So perhaps it's natural that our misunderstandings should be magnified at that intersection. However, what my research has shown that it is not our misunderstanding of the grand unified theory that is at the origin of these paradoxes. It was simply then, you know, having overlooked an effect that was predicted in 1917 by Einstein, and by the way, which is at the origin of lasers. The S in laser stands for stimulated, and the E after it for stimulated emission. So in fact, the process that makes lasers possible is in the end the process that also makes the information preservation in black holes possible.
This does give us laypersons a sense of just how hard and how patient the work is to advance science. So here you're going to something that Einstein realized in 1917, then going ahead to 1975 with Hawking's theory. Here we are at 2014, and you've been able to shed more light on that. And it really is a great reminder for those of us who are not scientists of really how much quiet, unseen work has to happen to move forward.
Yeah, and you know, given the fact that theoretical physics has now, you know, quite a venerable history, you know, it's difficult to be up to date, you know, on all of the developments in physics, and in fact, nobody can do that. However, what every, you know, graduate student in physics should attempt to do is to try to familiarize themselves at least with sort of the basics. You know, the relativity and the atomic physics and the elementary particle physics and the condensed matter physics. And nowadays, I think it is often that you can get your PhD or your doctorate in a very narrow area of physics and without being asked whether you have a well-broadened background. And I think some of the problems that we're running into is that, you know, scientists don't have a broad background in training. I happen to have had such a training that allowed me to while I was working on one thing, immediately see the connection to another thing. So for example, you know, my background includes high energy physics, nuclear physics, atomic physics, you know, quantum computation. So I have a very broad background knowledge, and that allowed me to connect the dots where other physicists perhaps weren't able to connect them simply because, you know, they had not read Einstein's paper. And I happened to have read it, and, you know, that rang a bell immediately. And I think it's a general lesson in most sciences. The greatest, you know, steps forward are being made by those people who are aware of similar developments, but perhaps in different fields, which in fact, you know, allows you to also work, you know, in between disciplines rather than just in a narrow wedge of a field of science.
Chris Adami is a theoretical physicist and a computational biologist from Michigan State University who believes that he has solved the hole in Stephen Hawking's black hole theory. Chris, it has been really fun to talk to you. Thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
And an invitation to join us tomorrow for a special State of Opportunity call-in program, Where Are the Answers? We look at whether Michigan's strategy for helping at-risk kids is working or failing. So join us tomorrow at 3 p.m. for State of Opportunity, Where Are the Answers? On Michigan Radio. Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer is Bob Skahn. Contributors are Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.